In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Axios World editor Lauren Whitney Gottbrath and Al Monitor senior news editor Joyce Karam discuss regional and global reaction to the escalating conflict between Israel and Hamas. Then we dig into Congress's role in foreign policy as the White House prepares to send its $100 billion supplemental funding request for aid to Israel and Ukraine. That conversation with Jordan Tama of American University's School of International Service. Plus, NPR's Morning Edition co-host and author Steve Inskeep discusses his latest book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. Now, Axios World editor Lauren Whitney Gottbrath and Al Monitor senior news editor Joyce Karam on the Israel-Hamas conflict.
Joyce, I'm going to start with you about the situation right now. I want to ask you about Gaza specifically. What's the humanitarian situation there?
Great to be with you, Mimi. It's a devastating situation. Just this morning, the numbers coming from Gaza indicate 4,000, at least 4,000 are dead. The wounded is above 12,000 at the moment. The hospitals, the United Nations said they have 24 hours before running out of fuel. We're looking at a very dire situation, an unprecedented catastrophe in Gaza. The airstrikes that we've checked this morning, the Israeli airstrikes have intensified. They're hitting harder inside Gaza. The trucks at the Rafah border with Egypt are still waiting. It's been...
So they were supposed to start moving this morning, local time.
They've moved, but they haven't entered. So now I was speaking to our correspondent on the ground this morning, and the expectation is that they would go in tomorrow, Saturday.
All right. And Lauren Whitney, turning to you, the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is in Israel, and in speaking with Netanyahu, he said, and here is CNBC, it says Israel's Netanyahu warns of a long war. What are the implications of that long war, and what are people saying about how long this long war could be?
Sure. So in terms of the implications more locally, it's undoubtedly will be much, much higher death tolls, particularly in Gaza, but also among Israeli military as well. And I think that's part of the reason Netanyahu continues to sort of warn his public about how long this war could be. And part of the reason we don't know exactly how long it will be, and we know it will likely be quite long. We know that Hamas has extensive tunnel systems and other systems in place that the Israeli military has said that it's their goal to destroy. Urban warfare is never easy. But we also don't necessarily know what the Israelis' end game is. We know that they want to destroy and dismantle Hamas, but we don't know exactly what they plan to do if they're able to achieve that goal, or at least achieve it in the way that they're hoping to. So we know that they've said they have no desire to, quote-unquote, reoccupy Gaza, but at the same time, they haven't really made it clear as to what an exit strategy would look like. And I think that's one thing that's actually very concerning to not only people who are watching this very closely, but also to Biden administration officials and European officials, too. You know, the longer this goes on, the heightened chance that it could turn into a much more regional conflict. And that's something that officials around the world are trying to prevent.
Well, Lauren Whitney, we're seeing satellite images of troops and armored vehicles amassing on the border with Gaza. Israeli generals have been saying, preparing their troops to see the inside of Gaza very soon. What do we know about Israel's plans for a ground war?
Sure. So the Israeli defense minister today actually spoke a little bit more about the potential ground offensive. He's described it as sort of a three-phase war, which obviously airstrikes and sort of getting into Gaza. We know They will likely focus a lot of efforts on Gaza City, very much they want to destroy what they say is Hamas infrastructure, and that includes this sort of really extensive tunnel system. But we also know Hamas is preparing for this ground invasion. So in terms of when it will happen, I think that's sort of a big question a lot of people have. Obviously, we did get some more signs that it could be soon with some of the comments from Israeli officials, but also we saw this morning Israel started evacuating a team that's very or a town that's very close to the Lebanese border. That could be another indication that they're preparing for something quite soon. But you know, at the end of the day, we do know the ground invasion is coming. As to when it comes is a big question mark, and we do know that it will likely cause the death tolls to continue to rise as this war progresses.
Joyce, let's talk about the organization Hamas itself. What are its resources? I mean, I think the extent of their weapons surprised the world and Israel, of course. How difficult would it be to dismantle that group completely?
Well, as you know, Mimi, Hamas is entrenched in Gaza. Hamas came to the scene in early 1980s. And it's an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Ideologically, they rely on charity, on outside funding, and they have huge resources on the ground as far as services for the people, whether it's hospitals, whether it's schools, other stuff. Militarily, a lot of the weapons that they've used in the October 7 massacre in Israel were home produced. So you're looking at locally produced things that they would do in their tunnels, that they would package together. The other support that's coming is coming from Iran, of course, but that has been limited since the blockade in 2007 on Gaza after Israel left. So they're very resourceful as far as producing weapons in-house.
But getting also those materials to produce those weapons given the blockade of Gaza.
They've been getting them through tunnels from Egypt, through the sea. We've seen reports that some have come through that. So all in all, they've been creative, and their power inside Gaza. I mean, we've seen so far 4 Israeli incursions into Gaza, and Hamas has only consolidated its power and gotten stronger. So there are a lot of questions now how this will be different. Can the goal that the Israeli prime minister have stated, destroy Hamas, can that work? It's a big question mark. But as far as Hamas itself, it's entrenched in Gaza now, whether it's public support, even for the humanitarian aid to come in. We heard from the White House yesterday that they're actually communicating indirectly with Hamas to let the humanitarian the aid in. So this is their enclave, this is their territory, and they're gonna fight tooth and nail. As Lauren was saying, this is shaping to be an ugly, long, and difficult war.
That was Lauren Whitney Gotbrath, world editor for Axios, and Joyce Karam, senior editor of the Mideast news site Al Monitor. Next, Jordan Tama of American University's School of International Service discusses Congress's role in foreign policy throughout history and today.
Not to state the obvious, but we don't have a House Speaker right now. Can you talk about the national security implications of what that means?
Well, it's a terrible time to not have a speaker from a national security standpoint. Israel is at war with Hamas. Ukraine's at war with Russia. Both of those countries have major needs. President Biden is asking for Congress to approve a major aid package for Ukraine and Israel. That package can't be approved if the House doesn't have a speaker. And if that package isn't approved, it would send a really bad signal to America's allies and partners overseas about the extent to which they can rely on the United States. Countries like Ukraine and Israel rely on America's support. And if that support isn't forthcoming, even when the president has made major speeches calling for it, that really would suggest that America is not able to play a strong leadership role in the world affairs.
And Congress has both formal and informal powers when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. Let's start with the formal. What are their duties and responsibilities?
Well, Congress actually has some very important formal powers under the Constitution. Probably the most important is the power of the purse. The president simply can't spend money on foreign policy programs, whether it's defense, foreign aid, diplomacy, unless Congress appropriates the money for that. And we're seeing that right now with aid for Ukraine and Israel. President Biden simply cannot provide new aid for Ukraine and Israel unless Congress provides that money through appropriations legislation. Congress also has the formal power of passing substantive legislation that shapes the content of U.S. foreign policy. Congress in recent years has passed many laws placing sanctions on a variety of countries, including Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. Right now, members of Congress are considering imposing new sanctions on Iran because of Iran's support for Hamas. And this is also a very important power of Congress. I expect if the House gets a speaker and begins operating again, it would pass legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran.
There's an article here from The Hill. It says this is the headline, McCall preparing authorization of military force against Hamas and Iran proxies. What does that mean? What's this authorization to use military force and Congress's role in outlining that?
Yeah, under the U.S. Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war. And in some of America's major conflicts historically, Congress did declare war. After Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, Congress declared war. Congress also can authorize the use of military force by the president by passing what's called an authorization for use of military force. Congress did this in 1990 after Iraq invaded Kuwait. It did it after the 9/11 attacks as an authorization for the use of military force against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It did it in 2002 to authorize the use of military force against Iraq, which led up to the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. This type of authorization that Congressman McCall is talking about would authorize the president to take military action against actors in the Middle East. The president might argue he can do that without congressional authorization. Typically, presidents say they don't need congressional authorization, that as commander-in-chief, they always have the power to take military action to protect the United States and its interests. But when Congress passes an authorization for use of military force, it empowers the president and certainly symbolically suggests that Congress is behind the president with regard to the possibility of using military force. It wouldn't require the president to use military force, but it would basically say the president can use military force if the president deems it's necessary.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered 2,000 troops to be ready to deploy to the Middle East. Is that something Congress has a say in?
Not generally, no. The president, as commander-in-chief, has the authority under the Constitution to move U.S. forces around as the president deems fit. It's a different matter if the president orders forces into combat. That's where Congress's power to declare war under the Constitution comes into play. Now, in 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution. And it was actually vetoed by President Nixon, but Congress overrode Nixon's veto, so this is still U.S. law. Under that resolution, the president has the authority to deploy U.S. forces into combat for up to 90 days, but is not allowed to have military forces in combat for more than 90 days unless they're authorized by Congress. So simply moving forces into the Mediterranean or moving them around in different parts of the Middle East is fully within the president's authority under the Constitution, but if the president ordered forces into combat and that lasted for more than 90 days, then Congress would need to authorize it in order for it to be in compliance with the War Powers Resolution.
That was Jordan Tama, an associate professor at American University's School of International Service. Next, a conversation with NPR's Morning Edition co-host and author Steve Inskeep about his new book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America.
NPR story I read estimated that there's about 15,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln, that he's the most written about person in history besides Jesus Christ.
Yes.
So what does Differ We Must add to our understanding of Abraham Lincoln?
I should mention I got to meet the head of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library the other day, who gave me an updated figure of 18,000 books. So you do hesitate before writing another one, like, what can I possibly add? And here's my answer to that. I'm a journalist. I'm covering a big, diverse, and fractious country. And so my perspective on Lincoln is looking at how he dealt with the divides of his time. And I tried to construct a story of his life through 16 meetings he had with people who differed with him, different background, different race, different gender, and above all, different opinion. Because I felt that through these meetings, where he was a politician, where he was dealing with people, trying to get something out of them, I would get a better picture of Lincoln and also learn something that was valuable for now.
16 conversations, 16 meetings, 16 a good number when you're talking about Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, it happened to work out that way.
The title, Differ We Must, it comes from a letter that Lincoln wrote. Who was he writing to?
He was writing to his best friend, Joshua Speed, who came from a slaveholding family. And when you just say that, I mean, some people would find that shocking. Why would you have anything to do with this person? Lincoln befriended him. They were very close. Speed admitted that slavery was wrong in the abstract. But Lincoln, in this letter that he wrote, said, fine that you admit that, but you're not serious about ending it politically. You're not serious about doing what is necessary. I disagree with you there. But having said that, he didn't disown his friend. He said, if for this we must differ, differ we must. And he signed the letter, Your Friend Forever. He kept this guy close. He kept working on him politically. And he eventually got some use out of him. When the Civil War came and Lincoln was president, Joshua Speed was a prominent citizen who helped him hang on for the Union to the important state of Kentucky.
So these 16 individuals that you focus on, how did you find them? How did you choose them?
I wish I could say that I had a brilliant system. But the way that I put together a book is I get out there and thrash around in the archives and get excited about something and start writing. And then I get stuck in the writing, and the getting stuck tells me that I don't know enough yet. And that sends me off and directs more research. So, I mean, a few of these characters I knew from the beginning that I would include. William H. Seward is one of the more famous ones. Frederick Douglass is a super famous one, who's the most important character in the book other than Lincoln. But others I had no idea about until I began my research, like Mary Ellen Wise, a woman who dressed as a Union soldier and said she fought for the Union and appeared in Lincoln's office demanding back pay. William Florville, a Haitian immigrant who was Lincoln's barber and had something to do with Lincoln's famous beard. There are a number of abolitionists and radicals and slave owners, people I had no idea about. I recognize all the thousands of books that are out there, but there is a lot in this work that was at least very new to me and has been new to some of the people who've read it.
Politician seen as a bad word these days. Right at the beginning of your book, you focus on the fact that Abraham Lincoln was a politician.
Yeah.
This is what you write. Abraham Lincoln was a politician. People like to identify him in ways that sound more noble, lawyer and statesman, husband and father, but this revered America's vocation is not revered at all, seen as the province of money and power and cynicism and lives. Lincoln persevered and preserved the country and took part in a social revolution because he engaged in politics.
Yeah, we're so disgusted with politics, and I understand why, because of the way that it is practiced sometimes. But the reality is that that is democracy. You can't really say you're in favor of democracy and not participate on some level in politics, whether it's voting intelligently, paying attention to the issues, volunteering on a campaign, writing about things. There are any number of ways to be involved. But politics is essential. And I think that that also is something we should use to judge our political leaders. I think that a lot of us tend to demand that our political leaders prevail 100% of our opinion all the time. And if they don't, they're weak. They are betraying us, any number of other things. And what politics requires is dealing with other people, not compromising your basic beliefs, but figuring out practical ways to get at least a little bit done.
He wasn't somebody who infuriated people. We know him as Honest Abe and known for his folksy stories. Where did he learn that, his ability to relate to people? And is that true?
Absolutely. I think he studied people all his life. There are accounts, even going back to his boyhood, of him studying adults in conversation. And when the conversation is over, having a million questions about what they said. He was thinking about people. He was thinking about human nature. But I do want to note a characteristic of him. You mentioned his folksy stories. He was a humorist. He was apparently very funny, although the record of his jokes sometimes leads something to be desired. But people were amused by him. They found him a very entertaining storyteller. but he didn't always tell them what it was that they wanted to know. He could be elusive in conversation. He could use his stories to change the subject or to avoid saying what his questioner most wanted to know. He had a friend named Leonard Sweat who said that Lincoln could give the impression of being totally candid while actually withholding so much as to have conveyed nothing to the person he was talking with. And this was part of his political style. He was not dishonest. He was not a liar, but he was exceptionally careful about what he said and only said those things that he thought would advance his cause.
Interesting that you talk about that story at a time when one of the reasons for the downfall of Kevin McCarthy that some of those who voted against him gave is that he made promises to them that weren't kept, and he made promises that were at odds with other promises he made to other people. Did Lincoln ever get caught up in something like that?
I think Lincoln avoided those kinds of things by falling silent. And I mean, without commenting exactly on McCarthy, Democrats certainly believed that he had promised to put a budget framework in place. And then he backed away from the whole thing and said, oh, I never exactly promised that. He somehow never managed to satisfy his right wing, even as he did that. Lincoln would cultivate slightly different versions of himself for different people. You could sense that. You can sense that in reading accounts of him. But it wasn't so far as to promise one thing to one person and promise the opposite to somebody else.
That was author and NPR Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep on his new book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Journal podcast. We want to make sure you know about our latest podcast, Books That Shaped America. It's a companion podcast to our 10-week television series of the same name. We've teamed up with the Library of Congress and selected 10 books from across American history that have had a major impact on our society. Each week, the C-SPAN television program will focus on one of these books and its impact. This companion podcast will give you more background on the book's authors. If you want to learn more about Books That Shaped America, go to our website, c-span.org. The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts.